So thank you for joining us today. It's really exciting to be here and share a little bit about our research with you. I'm Simone Whitecloud. I'm an ecologist. I'll give you a little more detail about my background in a bit. So today we'd like to talk about plants and their uses in Greenland. First, I'd like to take a moment to thank our supporters and getting us here. The Porter Family Fund at Dartmouth College and the National Science Foundation has funded some of this research through an IGERD grant for polar environmental change via Dartmouth College. And lastly, I'd like to thank the Humanities Division at the University of Chicago. And this is actually my first time presenting with a collaborator, so I realize I'm just saying I. But I mean we. Sorry about that. So the overview for our talk today is I'd like to talk a little bit about the project that we're working on, talk about the team, and give you an overview of Arctic plants. Then we'll talk about the peoples and languages of the Arctic and finish up with some case studies about some of these plants that we're studying in the Arctic. So there are three important things to know that sort of are the overarching facts for this research that we're doing about the plants and peoples of the North. And the first is that Arctic plants are circumpolar, so that means that they occur throughout all of the Arctic. And I'll give you some more information on that in a bit. Secondly, indigenous peoples and languages vary over the ranges of these plants, so there are different indigenous peoples throughout the Arctic over this continuity of plants throughout the Arctic. And lastly, there have been recent migrations of peoples across these plant ranges. So from these three facts, we've come up with two fundamental questions. The first is, how have plant names and uses changed with these migrations? And secondly, how has knowledge been affected by contact and language attrition? So a little bit about the team. As I said, I'm Simone Whitecloud, and my collaborator is Lenore Grenoble. I am Lac des Flambeaux Anishinaabeg, so my family's from Wisconsin. I've done most of my native plant uses and learning in California. My auntie married a man who's Cheyenne, so he's taught me most of what I know. My family's a part of the Bear Clan, so that's a picture of my feet on the top of the Greenland ice sheet. And I have bear feet tattooed on my feet as a reminder to walk the path of the bear. So it's an important part of my life. And one of the medicines we'll talk about today is one that I call bear medicine. So that's sort of my tie to some of this. And lastly, I'm a PhD candidate in ecology and evolutionary biology.
So I'm just a garden variety linguist. Simone objected to me talking about myself this way, but I'm an academic. I'm trained as a Slavic linguist. And here I am in Siberia giving an academic talk in an academic setting, but this I have been doing work on endangered languages in Siberia for some time now. So,
I wanted to share this quote with you. When I found it, I read it to Lenore and she totally cracked up. So this is from a journal on ethnobotany, a methods manual, and the quote, I'll go ahead and read it straight to you, is, "As you begin to search for a linguist who can accompany you in the field, you will likely find several types of potential collaborators. You may discover that there are university linguists who are specialized in one or more languages of your study area. But if you visit a university linguistics department, do not be surprised to find many researchers dedicated to contemporary approaches such as transformational linguistics or sociolinguistics." And one of the things that's been interesting for me being here is that everyone's really excited to see that there's a biologist here, and everyone says, oh, we need an ecologist in our research. So it's funny that I come from the other spectrum where they're saying I should go out and find a linguist to work with. So what brought us together? This is our photograph taken in Greenland of our IGERT, a part of our IGERT team. So IGERT is an NSF-funded grant that Dartmouth received. It stands for Integrated Graduate Education Research Traineeship, and it's a program whose goal is to train scientists to be interdisciplinary and work in the Arctic. So the main theme is polar environmental change, and it brings together ecologists, earth scientists, and engineers to study climate change in the Arctic. And Lenore was one of the PIs on this grant, and that's how we first came together. So I promised an overview of Arctic plants. Most people are surprised that there are plants in the Arctic. So you can see in the background, that's the Greenland ice sheet, right? It's melting quickly these days. But all of this landscape is covered with vegetation. So I wanted to share with you a little bit about how beautiful it is in Greenland. So there are a lot of beautiful flowers. This is a bluebell. You might recognize this. There are similar plants that grow sort of in gardens across the world. And there's actually a lot of greenery as well. So this is a beautiful shot of the things you'd find growing in wetter areas. One of these plants is a willow. You might be familiar with willows. And the other is a crowberry, right? But the scale of this is those leaves are about this big. So one thing to keep in mind about the Arctic is that everything's very small. And I did want to mention, one thing to keep in mind is because vegetation is so limited there, a lot of the diets of people tend to be meat and marine-based. So in thinking about doing research on plants, they aren't the primary source of food for these peoples. Really, only about 5% of their diet is plant matter, but it can often be, there's documentation that it's often an important part of vitamin supplements into the diet, especially in winter. So other cool facts about the Arctic flora, it's really easy to work there. There's only 1,500 species across all of the Arctic, right? There are 250,000 species in the world. So we've already narrowed it down to 1,500, which really isn't that much. And interestingly enough, across the Arctic, this idea of circumpolar plants, 60% of those plants are the same across the Arctic. As you go further north, so closer to the North Pole, that number increases to 90%. So that means all these different peoples are basically living with the same plants. So here's a map. Let me take a moment to acquaint you with it. You're looking at the North Pole here. At the very top is Alaska, and as you move down is northern Canada. Here's Greenland. Most of our research so far has been situated here. And here we have northern parts of Scandinavia and Siberia. This map represents the floristic zones, so the different types of vegetation that occur across the Arctic. But keep in mind that this is only varying by 40% at most to 10%. So most of these plants are the same. There's earlier reference to the idea of splitters and lumpers. This is kind of looking at it from a splitter's perspective, because really most of these plants are the same. And it ties nicely into this idea of migrating people and information. So we know that about 10,000 years ago, approximately, there was a land bridge that connected this area so that people were coming from Russia and into North America. Now what's interesting is that after this initial migration of indigenous peoples, there was a serious climate change event where the sea ice that normally fills all of this area in blue up north began to recede, and the indigenous people were able to follow the bowheaded whales, it was the Thule people, as the ice was receding. And so 1,300 years ago, these northern areas of Canada and across into Greenland were populated. So this was a recent migration. And I'll let you talk a little
bit. So now we're stepping into the linguistic part of this. This is the same region, as you can tell, but if we look at it linguistically, what's interesting for us as linguists is if you look at the blue here, this is the Eska-Aleut language family. So those people who were migrating came and settled along and left their language with them. So you have this language dialect continuum. It's a little bit interrupted because of differing times of migrations, but you can see where we're going with this. We have the plants, and we're looking at how the names are tracked across the Arctic. In terms of what's going on with the indigenous languages in the Arctic, they are all endangered to seriously endangered, with the exception of West Greenlandic or Kalaallisut, which is the official language of the country. It is the only Arctic indigenous language where the actual number of speakers has been growing. They're in a very enviable situation compared to everything else. The language is officially used. It's the language of education under self-government. It's the language of government. And children are growing up speaking Kalaallisut. So it's quite different. Of all of this blue area, the place where it's robustly spoken really is Greenland. So what we are looking at with this project is actually issues of reconstructing language. When you go back and look at the territories here, one of the funny things that's been happening in Greenland is, as a result of colonization, the people have largely lost their knowledge of how plants are traditionally used. Traditional knowledge, or local knowledge, or indigenous knowledge, goes by a lot of different names. It's a big issue right now. For anybody who works in the Arctic knows this. A lot of heated debate about how this kind of knowledge should be incorporated into the scientific research that's going on, in large part due to climate change in the Arctic. But what's very funny here is, where the language is robustly spoken, this traditional knowledge has largely been lost. And this is a little bit counterintuitive for all of us who are documenters. If you just read through the abstracts for this conference, people are talking about documenting knowledge and culture while it's still there. The language is spoken quite fluently, and yet people feel that the knowledge is lost. They probably haven't lost as much knowledge as they think they have. So when you first ask them about how you use plants, they say, we don't use plants, or we don't know, we're trying to learn that, we don't know at all. But,
so yeah. I have an interesting example of this. I went to interview an elder with a translator, and when I got there, the first thing she says to me is, oh, I don't know anything about plants. But the translator had said, no, you should meet with her because she likes to press plants, so she knows about plants. So, you know, she says, I don't know anything, and then in a few minutes, she says, you have a cold. I want to make a tea for you. Mm-hmm. And she got some leaves from some local plants that she had collected herself and made me this tea, and had a very specific way of how much to make it and who can use it. And so she definitely had knowledge, though she didn't claim to have it.
So one of the questions we've been asking, people are very excited about this project in Greenland. They really want us to figure out how to use the plants and bring them back this knowledge. So the first question is, who are the experts? We have conducted, we're just really at the beginning of what could be a major project if we get all of the languages in the Arctic all the way across, but we have been conducting our own interviews with self-identified experts, and we ask people, who should we talk to, and they have ideas. Some other interviews were conducted by people, and they've been deposited at the Greenland National Archives and Museum, and the person who's overseeing that there is very happy to collaborate with us and is sharing all of her materials, and we're sharing our materials with them. One of the interesting things that we have is something that I will call the Bible as we go on. This is Sami's.set of information that was collected by a Danish woman who was living in southern Greenland, and people know about this. We have published field guides, and I brought the field guide. I bought this in the bookstore in Nuuk. And for those of you working with seriously endangered languages, you would die to have this. It's bilingual, nice pictures. It's a real field guide. It's bilingual, Kalaallisut, Danish, with the scientific names. It says nothing about the uses of the plants, but it gives even little maps showing where they grow. So there's a scientific guide, and it's really done in the Western tradition of science. So we have all that. That's really great. We have published sources that are aimed for non-scientists, and we'll look at Walking with Alassi in a minute. We have a few scientific articles about things that were conducted, research that was conducted earlier. There's anthropological and ethnographic accounts, which are sometimes quite spotty. And one of the things that you see is linguists who were recording the languages, and these languages have all been studied, or all these varieties, this Eskaalut or the Inuit languages we're specifically focusing, have been studied. There's dictionaries. But largely, linguists did not think to ask about these plant names. They're plants that you don't know, that I don't know. And so just the names aren't recorded. The other thing we have that I don't think is here is we actually have cookbooks. The sources are written in a variety of languages. We have them in Danish, English. They must be in French because Inuktitut is spoken in Canada. We have things in Inuktitut and in Kalaallisut or Greenlandic. Sort of one of the points is here, why she needs me. Because she's a biologist. She can't read all these languages. This is one of the most interesting sources that we have. This is Walking with Alassi, which I was telling you about. We found out about this because somebody in Greenland said, oh, if you really want to know about how to use plants, was a friend of mine said, oh, you should show this to Simone. This is the book that she needs. As you can see, if it shows up at all, the it's bilingual, it's in English, and Inuktitut, but the Inuktitut is written in syllabics. Kalakisut is not written. Kalakisut is written in the Roman alphabet. So this is really not legible to the Greenlanders unless they've actually studied the syllabary. And so as a result, they are getting the information from an Inuktitut speaker via English. This gives us just a different idea of what traditional knowledge looks like. A cookbook, and I just found this very interesting, the cookbook has recipes in three different languages, and they're all coded for traditional Greenlandic fare, Norse fare, colonial Greenlandic fare, contemporary Greenlandic fare. But the cookbook itself says, this doesn't show up very well, three different recipes, says that, you know, some of them are obviously invented with a modern flavor. So who are the experts? One of the people who was quickly identified to us as the expert in Greenland on the use of plants is Anna-Sophia Hardenberger, Anso. She's identified as the culinary ambassador to Greenland. This is from the web, that's her title. This is a quote, if you Google her, you'll see this is a picture from the web where she's teaching people to cook Greenlandic style. So we wanted to interview her, and we had no problems doing this because when I live in Greenland, I actually stay in her house. So that was easy. She is an award-winning cookbook author. This is from the Siku News. This is her cookbook, which is in Danish and Kalakisut, and it uses very creative ingredients. It's not what you would call traditional Inuit cooking. The whole Igert group went and spent a day learning to cook Inuit style, and here she is showing us a caribou leg and how to butcher it. We're in her kitchen. That's me leaning over there. And we went back, Simone and I went back, and spent some time recording her knowledge of plants. She was giving this to us all in English. She was going through plant after plant after plant. And then finally, she was reading something. So finally I said, where are you getting this information from? So she showed it to us, and this is a couple of pages I've scanned in. This is what I was calling the Bible before. This is the information that was collected by the Danish woman in southern Greenland. And I don't know how well it shows up. It's all in Danish. It's absolutely all in Danish, except the Kalakisut name is here. So she'd gone through all these plants, and then I said, could you please record some of this so we have the sound files? Because this is a documentation project, after all. And she looked at me and she said, in Kalakisut? And I said, yes, in Kalakisut. She thought I was nuts. She thought I was just totally nuts that I wanted this in the language. She just cared about the information. So we were surprised with that. And now we'll quickly turn it over to two case studies.
So the plants that we're going to cover, the first is, the scientific name is Angelica archangelica, so the common name is Angelica. And the second is a plant that has two different species that share the same common name. So the common name is Labrador tea, and the scientific names are Ledum palustre subspecies decumbens and Ledum groenlandicum. Side note, groenlandicum means collected in Greenland. So this is one that was first found in Greenland.
This is a mock-up from the, we have a web online database that we are using to enter different information because we're working in different locations, but ultimately the presentation will be something like this, and we can get to maps and languages. We have the linguistic facts in there. You can pull up recipes. We have it in English, Kalakisut, and we'll put it in Danish. We have to keep moving.
Okay, so Angelica is what I call bear medicine, and to find out that people eat it was crazy, because where I come from, it's strong medicine, and you chew it during ceremony. And this is, Anso was kind enough to show us how she prepares it, so this is drying Angelica in her kitchen.
So what we're doing with this from the linguistic standpoint, this is just to give you a brief idea. I don't know if you don't care about these languages, you don't care about the data, but we're looking at what's going on with the names right now, and also collecting texts and the recipes, full documentation. But you can see the Kalakisut up at the top. The field guide gives three different names for it. We always get Kuanak, and I ask people at the language secretary about the other two, four, and they just say those are different. So I haven't. That needs more research. Fortescue and others in this etymological dictionary trace it possibly back to the Old Norse, which would suggest that the name for the plant and its uses perhaps came from Europe with the Europeans. But
if you think about that map that I showed you and about these migrations of people, Angelica, a different species but same genus, is the Chinese herb called Dong Quai, which is used really often in Chinese medicine. So it's also possible that this plant knowledge came along this migration. So it's these sorts of things that we're interested in investigating.
Let me just say one more linguistic thing. You can see, if you get down to Inuktitut, it's not really clear, and this is one reason we as linguists need to work with people who know what's going on. It looks like, according to Fortescue, the cognate term refers to an edible seaweed. Schneider, 1985, says that there's two different words here, seaweed with the geminate N and the single N for Angelica. We just have to investigate this. We just don't know. And it's, we just don't know. So there's interesting linguistic problems.
So the second species is Labrador tea, as pictured here. And this is a tea that's known really commonly to have been used by explorers and by trappers as a stimulant.
We have actually less linguistic data about this one. It's widely used throughout the Arctic. It's really well known. When we got to Greenland, it was the plant that Simone was looking for and knew about. And yet, my dictionary search part of it is that there's two different varieties, both called Labrador tea in the common name in English. You see the different Latin names. And so far, this is all I've gotten. This clearly isn't cognate in Inupiaq in Alaska. So this just needs some more. A lot more work.
So lastly, we wanted to close with the challenges that are encouraging this collaboration. So from my point of view, there are challenges in plant identification. So there are places where this Labrador tea is referenced, and we don't know which species they're talking about. And so for Lenore to see that, she needs to come to me and say, you know, can you figure out by the range maps which one they might be talking about, or some sort of other context. There are also challenges for linguistics, which is where I go to Lenore.
Yeah, just tracing the etymologies, and then, of course, what we're hoping to do is get recordings of narratives about how to prepare the plants, how to collect them, how to do everything with the plants in the languages themselves, understanding the languages and names, and really just assessing and reconstructing the information itself is really complicated.
And then lastly, I wanted to leave with this photograph and a little tidbit of information. The photograph that we pictured at the beginning of the talk, and here again, these beautiful pink flowers, is the national flower of Greenland. The name for it is Niviarsiak in Greenlandic. Fireweed is a common name here. It grows in Alaska. You might have seen it before. But Niviarsiak in Greenlandic means little girl. But when you look more at what these uses mean, it also turns out that this is a plant that's used in teas to increase lactation. So we're interested in looking for stories like this where the name is reflective of the use of the plant as well. So with that, thank you very much, and we'll take questions. Question?
Yeah, so there's this restaurant in Copenhagen called Noma, which has recently been declared